Hello, everyone, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, coming to you from Studio P10 on a chilly autumn day in Prague, and I'll be your host this week. Coming up in The Blender, correspondent Greg Pfeiffer travels to Russia's North Caucasus Republic of Dagestan, where he reports how years of violence are tearing society apart at the seams.
So many people were killed and no one punished for it. The authorities don't enforce the law. That's why people dislike them.
And we talked to Central Asia reporter Bruce Pannier about what lies ahead for Kyrgyzstan following the recent election of Almazbek Atambayev as the country's new president.
Russia has been, is, and will be Kyrgyzstan's closest partner. Whereas the U.S. base in Kyrgyzstan is meant for supporting the operation in Afghanistan, the Russian base in Kyrgyzstan is specifically there to safeguard stability in Central Asia.
But first to cyberspace, which continues to grow in importance as a platform for the exchange of free and transparent information worldwide. Officials and activists from more than 60 countries recently gathered in London for a two-day conference on the future of the Internet, as well as efforts by China and Russia to curtail free speech rights on the web. Just ahead of the conference, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sat down to discuss a new role for the Internet in reaching out to a third country, Iran. Clinton said the United States is due to launch a virtual Tehran embassy, using the Internet to forge a direct connection with the Iranian people. She made the announcement in an interview with Kambiz Hosseini, a host of Voice of America's popular satirical program, Parazit. During the conversation, her first ever with Persian language media, she also issued a blunt assessment of the Iranian military's increasing influence on the government in Tehran.
Do you believe the Islamic Republic of Iran is a dictatorship?
I do. I believe the regime is a dictatorship, and I think it's becoming even more of one. In fact, I think it is moving toward being a military dictatorship. I heard recently the idea that there wouldn't even be an elected president, that the system would be changed. There is a great deal of sadness on my part when I look at the strength and resilience of the Iranian people, the creativity, the intellect, the history and culture, and see the very narrow-minded and unfortunately oppressive regime that is trying to control what the Iranian people do.
President Obama called Libya a recipe for success. At one point, you think that we're going to cook something for Syria or some other countries?
Well, but look at the ingredients in Libya. You had an uprising of people that was brave. Some might have even said foolish when it started because they were up against a government with a leader who called them rats and dogs and threatened to kill them and go house to house to do that. And there was just such a desire that it was organic. It came from within. You then had requests from the people themselves in Libya for outside help. You then had appeals for help from the region, the Arab League, the Gulf Coordinating Council. You then had the United Nations recognizing the importance of responding to the people. In Syria, you don't have that, at least not yet. The opposition is very clear. They don't want outside interference. They don't want any kind of, you know, military activity on their behalf. They don't really want Iran supporting the government, and they don't want others coming in from the outside. So I think that what President Obama was referring to was the way the people of Libya themselves, just as in a different approach, the people of Egypt, the people of Tunisia have liberated themselves. Some required more help than others, but it was an action by the people.
Do you think Iranian people need help in that regard?
Well, I remember back in 2009, at that time, the Green Movement and the people that were communicating with our government said, we don't want your help. We don't want you to be identified with our struggles. This has to be just by us, and we respected that. So we're not seeking a conflict with the regime in Iran. We're seeking to support the people of Iran. And by doing so on the outside, through our assertions that their aspirations for freedom are legitimate, by providing tools to circumvent the electronic curtain that the regime has tried to impose on Iran. So we are also trying to open up to more student exchanges. You know, I gave an announcement a few months ago. We want to see more students coming back to the United States to study, so we are trying to streamline the visa process. We hope by the end of the year we will have a website, so we'll have a virtual embassy Tehran that people will be able to go to get information. Online, we try to provide educational advice and other support for the Iranian people. So my goal in speaking with you today is to clearly communicate to the people of Iran, particularly the very large population of young people, that the United States has no argument with you. Yeah. We want to support your aspirations. We would be thrilled if tomorrow the regime in Iran had a change of mind and said, you know, why are we suppressing the brilliance of our young people? Let's let the future of Iran flourish. And so we will try to help in whatever way we can and that we are requested to do.
Ali from Mashhad asked on the issue of sanctions. One group believes that sanctions puts pressure on people, such as sanctions on airplane parts. This airplane parts are very sensational in Iran. People have a lot of questions about that. And also, he says, another group believes that only sanctioning oil and the central bank will alter the Islamic Republic's actions. What's your opinion?
Well, I know that sanctions are sometimes controversial because, of course, they are a tool of diplomacy, coercive diplomacy, as opposed to conflict. No one, certainly speaking for our government, wants a conflict, but we do want to influence and hopefully change the behavior of the regime. And I want to remind us that the strongest sanctions were adopted by the United Nations when it became abundantly clear that the regime is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Everyone believes that the covert actions, the covert facilities, the misleading information is part of an attempt by the regime to acquire nuclear weapons, which would be very destabilizing. And in the face of that kind of evidence, the entire international community, including traditional partners of Iran, have said, we have to do something.
Yeah.
So the sanctions are necessary, and we do want to do them in a way that doesn't impose suffering on the people of the country. But we are trying, as President Obama said he would, to follow a two-track approach. We have tried to negotiate. We have tried to engage. We've made it very clear that Iran is entitled to civilian nuclear energy power, but not nuclear weapons. And so we've tried to engage and have not yet been successful, and we've tried to use sanctions to create conditions that would bring the Iranian regime to engagement and diplomatic efforts.
Fatima from Tehran asked, what kind of new sanctions can we expect to see?
Well, you mentioned some that people are talking about, the central bank, for example. We also have seen a disturbing trend of the Iraqi Revolutionary Guard Corps becoming more and more involved in the economy of the country, the Quds Force and other elements of the security establishment, taking financial stakes or taking over certain economic enterprises. That's part of what I mean about are seeing that there seems to be a moving toward a more military takeover in effect inside Iran. So we're looking at different sanctions. But we also continue to invite the regime to negotiate. And recently, President Ahmadinejad had a statement where they would be willing to negotiate on behalf of the so-called P5 plus one, which are the permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany. The High Representative of the European Union, Cathy Ashton, responded. Now we've not gotten anything yet back from the regime.
That was Parizeet host Kambiz Hosseini's interview with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Voice of America's Parizeet program is watched in Iran via satellite and YouTube, and its Facebook page receives close to 20 million views per month. You can watch the full VOA video interview with Secretary Clinton by going to our website at rfurl.org.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуще.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатліть Радіос.
Азатліцюн ДТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Next to the North Caucasus, which is perhaps most familiar to Western audiences because of Russia's two brutal wars in the Republic of Chechnya. But continued fallout from those conflicts has triggered massive instability throughout the entire region, with militancy and counterterrorism operations wreaking havoc on traditional ways of life. RFE correspondent Greg Pfeiffer recently traveled to the North Caucasus. Here, he reports from Dagestan, where one mountain village has been shattered by an ongoing cycle of violence.
The tin roofs of Gyumri glint in the bright midday sun high amid the jagged peaks of Dagestan's Caucasus Mountains. This small village is so remote, residents speak of Russia as if they're in another country. But there's another reason people here are turning away from Moscow's control. Security forces recently sealed off this village during a counter-terrorism operation that lasted a year and a half. Among the village elders, Nabi Magomedov breaks down crying as he describes how it began. He says militants lured his son, a prominent member of Dagestan's parliament, out of his house, saying they wanted to talk.
They promised they wouldn't shoot, but when he came out, they shot him 62 times.
Chechen rebel leader Doku Umarov later took credit for ordering the killing. Speaking in a grainy video posted on the internet, Umarov accused the younger Magomedov of betraying Islam by cooperating with the authorities. But if the counterterrorism operation in Gyumri was meant to combat such extremism, it did the opposite. Residents say that in addition to daily house-to-house searches, thousands of troops bristling with weapons cut down farmers' trees, killed livestock, and stole whatever they could from the very poor people who live here. Magomedov says they also shot villagers in what he calls a reign of terror.
So many people were killed, and no one punished for it. The authorities don't enforce the law. That's why people dislike them.
Some are protesting by turning to radical Islam. They say they're refusing to observe Russian law and adopting Sharia law instead, or at least their understanding of it. Construction workers are busy building a new madrasa, an Islamic religious school. And young men from Gyumri and other villages are leaving their homes to join militant groups behind bombings and shootings that take place almost daily across Dagestan. Locals call it going into the forest. The call to prayer rings out at a ramshackle conservative Muslim Salafist mosque. Some of the young men attending midday prayers here sport dark beards and military fatigues. Among them, Abu Magomedov says adopting Salafism is the only way to protest the unfairness of daily life.
Those who go into the forest want to get closer to God, because Sharia represents everything good in the world, because most people live in denigration and filth, and our politicians deceive us.
Magomedov says acts such as the assassination of Dagestan's interior minister 2 years ago is justified as justice and retribution. Many of the attacks take place here. 200 kilometers to the east in the chaotic capital, Makhachkala, including the bombing of a liquor store that killed a police officer and wounded 60 others last month. At a hospital a short walk away, some of the victims lie bandaged on cots in a hot, crowded room 2 days after the blast. Magomed Gitinov says he was on a busy street leaving a friend's apartment when the bomb went off, shattering buildings' facades and sending shrapnel into his side. He calls those who carried out the bombings monsters and blames massive unemployment for prompting many young men with little to do to turn to violence.
They're confused. They lose their morals, start turning into religious extremists and blow up innocent people because they believe they're going to take over the world.
Gitinov says the regular attacks are making residents afraid to go outside and that the violence is getting worse. Many here believe the root of the problem is the pervasive corruption choking the economy. They say huge development funds are being pilfered by officials in Moscow and Makhachkala. Some of the money is spent on luxury cars and an expanding ring of houses going up outside the capital. There's a lot also going into the local soccer club. Fans roar at a small Soviet-era stadium during an evening match in central Makhachkala. But this isn't just any soccer game. The local team was bought by a Dagestani billionaire earlier this year. He hired the star Cameroonian player Samuel Eto'o, whose reported salary of $30 million per season makes him the highest ever paid footballer. But the show has done little to create any real sense of normalcy. Svetlana Isaeva started the group Mothers of Dagestan for Human Rights after her 25-year-old son disappeared 3 years ago. She says many young men like him are detained by security forces, forced to confess to terrorism, and often killed.
Lately, it's become common among law enforcers to burn people alive in their cars. Then they're accused of blowing themselves up by accident.
Isaeva says the abductions began taking place regularly after troops were moved here from neighboring Chechnya in 2007, after the war there wound down.
All that equipment, all those people. What was the military supposed to do? They need conflict to continue surviving. That's the only way I can explain it.
Isaeva fears the instability will only worsen, saying she's frightened Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is almost certain to return to the presidency next year. He's been in power more than a decade, and, she says, it all started under him.
That was Greg Pfeiffer reporting on growing violence and desperation in Russia's Republic of Dagestan. A complete package of Pfeiffer's reporting from the North Caucasus can be found on our website at rferl.org.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet and television news to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
And finally to Kyrgyzstan, which on October 30th held presidential elections for the first time since massive public protests last year led to the ouster of the previous leader, Kurmanbek Bakiyev. Bakiyev was seen as widely corrupt, but his toppling sparked deep unrest between various political factions in the Central Asian nation and led to deadly clashes in the nation's south. The man who looks set to become the next Kyrgyz president, Almazbek Atambayev, was an outspoken critic of Bakiyev's, but also served briefly as his prime minister. I sat down with Central Asia correspondent Bruce Pannier to talk about Atambayev's chances for bringing Kyrgyzstan's season of instability to an end. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the basics. Almazbek Atambayev is generally known as a political moderate and a very astute businessman who built his fortune in the publishing industry and in some manufacturing deals. But what more do we know about him?
Well, not long after independence, he started out his political career. He was one of the co-founders of the Social Democrat Party in 1993. He did show up as an opposition figure, although he didn't get very much publicity. He wasn't very well known until the late 1990s, but he was sufficiently known, certainly by the 2000 presidential elections, that he gave it a run. He only got a little more than 6% of the vote, as I remember, but it helped get his name out there. And he played some role in the 2005 revolution that ousted Akayev, but not a big one. He was kind of a subordinate to people like Rosa Otunbayeva and Kurmanbek Bakiyev.
Just to throw in, you're talking about Askar Akayev, who was the Soviet-era leader who became the first post-independence president, and he was thrown out in the Tulip Revolution in 2005.
Right. Of course, you'd have to qualify that Askar Akayev, although it's right to say he was a Soviet-era leader, he was actually a second-round choice.
Okay, well, let's pick up from the revolution you were saying he was playing. He played a sort of...
Yeah, I mean, he
role.
Wasn't, you know, he was, as I said, he'd run in presidential elections, so he was getting to be in 2000, I mean, and so he was getting to be better known, certainly. But he wasn't really one of the major forces, although it's hard to say that anyone was particularly a major force in the opposition because in 2005, because what happened to Askar Akayev was kind of just a result of mass discontent more than the opposition actually guiding any protest to oust him from power. However, after that is when I would say, when I personally would mark Atambayev's career as having picked up a lot, because he came out not simply as a critic of the Bakiyev government, but certainly as one of the most vocal critics. He was practically the voice of the opposition in the days leading up to the November 2006 protest that forced constitutional changes on the Bakiyev government. They were quickly undone. But anyway, he was, from that moment on, I would say, a political force within Kyrgyzstan, enough so that, well, Bakiyev took him seriously and offered him, of course, the job of prime minister, which he accepted in 2007. He didn't even make it to the end of the year, of course, and went right back into the opposition after that. But he was, as I said, he'd sufficiently built up his power base that he was able to make another run for the presidency in 2009 and was certainly the leading challenger of Bakiyev in that early poll. He only got about 8.5% of the vote, but then again, he withdrew halfway through the day, so he might have actually got 10 or 12%.
He withdrew because he claimed that there was massive voter fraud. And
right, that it was a rigged election, and there was a number of accusations that he leveled. So by then he was sufficiently well known. He went back to the opposition camp, but of course, now this is not unusual for Kyrgyzstan that this stuff happens, that people, almost anyone that served in the government, certainly more than half, were probably in the opposition somewhere in the last decade. It's not so unusual, but it does kind of undercut their credibility, at the same time, because people see that there is at least some aspect of opportunism in these people. There's this kind of cynicism on the part of the population that politicians are interested in politics at least as much for personal interest as for actually trying to do something to improve the situation in the country. Yeah, I mean, we can just look at Atambayev's, the three runs that he made. He got, like I said, a little more than 6% in 2000. He got 8.5% in 2009, and now all of a sudden he's got 63%. The fact that he got 63% doesn't necessarily mean to me anyway that it shows that he's incredibly popular. He was just happened to be probably the best in most people's minds among the pack that they had to choose from.
Well, a lot of people made the point or made the argument that because he was situated in Bishkek and he's the prime minister of the outgoing interim leader, Rosa Otunbayeva, that he had the best access to resources in addition to his own personal finances, and that he was best placed to wage a successful campaign.
Well, and some of his, before the campaign even started, some of his at the time opponents, and some of them dropped out later, pointed out that he chose the last weeks before he had to resign as prime minister to start touring the country just to check and make sure that everything was okay. This was one of the first times when people started saying, well, this is abuse of administrative resources, because he was getting coverage and on television and in the media because he was touring all the regions of the area, you know, and promising that things would improve. As prime minister, you would expect he would have to do that, but the timing was suspect because he didn't start this until the beginning of September, and by the end of the month he had had to step down as prime minister in order to run his campaign for the presidency. So, you know, that already raised some questions about what was going on with his government, and was this really going to be an above-the-board election? And I imagine those questions are going to linger for a long time.
Well, so. I wanted to ask you about that because just as the election may be remembered by many people in terms of the many flaws that were reported, possible abuse of administrative resources, he's also tied to a very critical political shift in the country, which was the decision last year to go from a presidential system to a parliamentary one. And of course, Kyrgyzstan is the lone exception in Central Asia, which is a region that's marked by, you know, longstanding autocrats who have either entered or are entering their third decade of power. He was essential in pushing some of those reforms through when he was prime minister. Now he's going to be president. Can we expect that he is going to stand by his pledge to maintain a strong parliamentary system, or will we see a slight shift back towards a stronger executive?
You know, I think a lot that's going to be determined by events that come in the future. I mean, certainly he wasn't one of the architects of the Constitution. Technically, then I don't think he was prime minister when they were drafting the Constitution. But he was one of the architects of that. And he seems to believe that that's the right system. To the credit of the people of Kyrgyzstan, the parliamentary system has held for more than a year. And I think that was probably the biggest fear that a lot of people, certainly outside Kyrgyzstan, had, was that the parliamentary system wouldn't even last until they'd had presidential elections. So that in itself is a victory, that it's made it that far. Now, if you want to debate, you know, the accomplishments of parliament, that's something totally different. I personally don't see that they've done a whole lot there. And for this system to survive, they're going to have to show that a parliamentary system can move the country forward, and there is a number of problems, but they're going to have to isolate one or two particular issues and try to move forward with that just to show everybody that they are making progress. To date, honestly, I really haven't seen very much.
Okay, let me ask you about two issues that he's going to face in the near future, and he's already made comments about both. The first is the U.S. airbase at Manas, which is the transit point for all troops coming in and going out of Afghanistan. Kyrgyzstan is unique in that it's the only country in the world that hosts both Russian and American military bases, and it's an uncomfortable relationship at times. Atambayev is seen as very close to Russia, and one of the very first remarks he made upon his election was to say that Manas was going to be closed in the near future, and went so far as to say that it presented a security risk for Bishkek if it suddenly came under attack, that the entire city could be razed. It was quite a dramatic remark. He quickly rolled that back and went back to what he had been saying initially, even before the election, which is that the U.S. could use the base through the end of its lease, which is in 2014, which coincides with the scheduled withdrawal from Afghanistan. So what was that all about? What's going to happen?
Well, you know, on the one hand, of course, this base has been a lightning rod. I mean, he's the fourth president now that's had to deal with this issue. You know, the one thing that you always have to remember about this was, as long as the U.S. was fighting terrorism in Afghanistan, it was useful to Kyrgyzstan for their own personal reasons that there was a U.S. presence, or at least that they would allow the U.S. to use the base, because insecurity in Afghanistan is necessarily means insecurity in Central Asia. So if the Americans were willing to go down there and take on the terrorists and keep the terrorists down there, and Taliban and people like that, then that was absolutely to the benefit of Kyrgyzstan. Now, of course, they know that they're going to get out in 2014, and if you're the Kyrgyz government at this point, you got to look a little bit longer term. I mean, again, they have a number of problems that they have to deal with in the next few years. Russia has been, is, and will be, as we've heard many times, Kyrgyzstan's closest partner. Russia also has a base, and whereas the U.S. base in Kyrgyzstan is meant for supporting the operation in Afghanistan, the Russian base in Kyrgyzstan, technically the CSTO base in Kyrgyzstan, is specifically there to safeguard stability in Central Asia. So it's a long-term commitment. Russia is ultimately the partner for Kyrgyzstan and, you know, 20, 50, 100 years down the road, as far as we can see now, obviously things will change, but certainly to the mind of Kyrgyz officials looking long term, Russia is the partner that they're going to have in the region for a long, long time.
You mentioned a lot of the difficult issues that lie ahead for the future Kyrgyz president and government, and probably one of the most difficult ones is the issue of the regional divide between north and south in Kyrgyzstan, and of course the continued ethnic tensions in the south between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz. And you, of course, were in Osh in June 2010 at the time of the clashes between these two groups that were horrific. Nearly 500 people were killed, the bulk of them Uzbeks. This all unfolded at a time when Atambayeva was the acting president. Atambayev was the vice premier, I believe, and he's since tried to present himself as a very active candidate in terms of promoting reconciliation and rebuilding in the south. But there's no doubt that those tensions remain. Exacerbating it is the fact that he's from the north and he ran against two popular candidates from the south. So what hope do we have that he's going to be successful in bridging this regional divide?
Well, I mean, obviously the first thing that we have to consider is they're going to have to do some kind of reformation within the parliament structure now. And I mean, I would just expect that the prime minister will be someone from the south. It seems unavoidable. Otherwise, if he picks somebody from the north, then they're going to have problems right away. North and South Kyrgyzstan are just very, very different places. I can't possibly blame the government for the situation that they got. This is a much older problem than that. The South has had people living there for thousands of years. It's far more religious than the North, you know, and we just have to look at, we'll just use the two biggest cities as an example. Osh, by some accounts anyway, is 3,000 years old. Bishkek, the capital, 100 years ago was a pit, you know. I mean, it was just kind of a way station, the first place that you came to out of the mountains. The population wasn't even 20,000. It's just a place that the Soviet planners in Moscow picked and said, this is going to be where we're going to build the city. So the North is a relatively new region. It's industrialized. To the mind of Kyrgyz, certainly in the North, it's the more modernized, contemporary might be a better way of looking at it. Whereas the South is an old place with deep traditions, and part of those traditions are a great mix of people who have lived in the area, you know, for hundreds of years, certainly, and in some cases, thousands. Although the Uzbek-Kyrgyz clashes were a bad thing, I personally don't think that that's the biggest problem in Kyrgyzstan right now. I don't think that the ethnic Kyrgyz biggest problem is with other ethnic groups in Kyrgyzstan. I think the biggest problem the Kyrgyz people have is amongst themselves. President Bakiyev going down there after he'd been ousted from power was probably the worst thing that could have happened, because there was ethnic Kyrgyz that supported him and there was ethnic Kyrgyz that didn't support him. And in general, the South felt they'd been left out of the whole process that ousted Bakiyev in the North. And now that's just been aggravated 100 times. I mean, there's people that agree with what happened to the Uzbeks in June 2010, and there's people that don't, you know, in the South. That's probably the first thing that any Kyrgyz government would have to overcome, is to try to unify that country and unify the Kyrgyz as a people, at the same time giving them a comfortable feeling that they are in charge, they are the masters of the country. Kyrgyzstan is the country of the Kyrgyz now, something they never had before. And as soon as people are comfortable with that notion, then you can probably be more inclusive with some of the other ethnic groups.
So Atambayev has his work cut out for him.
Yeah, besides the fact that economically he's got nothing to deal with practically at all. So, I mean, any problem you can name, practically Kyrgyzstan has it right now. The only thing they really have is democracy, what they say is democracy anyway.
That was correspondent Bruce Pinier talking about Kyrgyzstan and its new president, Almazbek Atambayev. And that's it for The Blender this week. Thanks for tuning us in. I'm Daisy Sindelar. Joining me behind the glass is our tireless producer, Tanya Kuncheva. And we and the rest of The Blender staff will see you next week.